It is Tuesday, December 27th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It is number two in our offerings of best of 2022. Can't believe the year went that quickly. Today, Lily Geismer, professor of history at Claremont McKenna College. We've had her on the program, I think, three or four times now. Discussing her recent book, Left Behind, the Democrats' Failed Attempt to Solve Inequality. Important to see where peeps have gone wrong to get it right going forward.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you agree, Emma Vigeland?
I would agree. And Lily Geismer is excellent. And this interview definitely deserved to be on Best Of's. I will say that.
I don't know who nominated it, but we put it through the committee vote, and we did the alkaline testing that we do on all of these products.
Thing. I mean, we paid a lot of money for that machine that does the raffle balls. It doesn't seem necessarily worth it.
It doesn't. I'm not. Yeah, that was one of the. I'm going to concede that was probably an unnecessary purchase.
Okay.
But
we live and we learn.
We'll tell you. It's part of our Giving 2022 series that we're doing, which is basically just about giving you best of so that we can give each other a vacation.
One of the people who suggested this interview was a fan, Jeremy Rosenberg. So thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Wow, look at you. All right.
What's his address, too? He's going to give us full details.
Yep. So if you don't like it, it's that guy's fault, and go visit him. So, yeah, maybe we don't need to do last names, probably. Bradley. But yeah, okay.
You want to post his plane coordinates too?
There we go.
His assassination coordinates.
Assassination coordinates.
If you dox, you get suspended.
So enjoy this. And then, as a special treat, after this, maybe some of you messed it. Over the summer, there were some days that my son was just not going into camp. Was just not into going to camp. You know, coming out of COVID, kids have new sets of anxieties and this and that. And I'm like, dude, you're going to have to come down to work with me. He's like, okay. I'm like, but I'm no iPad. Okay. I'm like, all right, darn it. And, but it actually ended up being, he came into work like four or five times, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe more even.
I don't know if you remember, Saul made an awesome tech deck ramp, like obstacle course.
Dude, I got it in the other room. And then I got down here his, hold on for one second, I'll show you this.
Yeah.
Vamp for a second, Emma.
I will.
That is not vamping, incidentally. That is like some type of jazz thing that you're
doing.
Yeah,
I'm scared.
This is he made a pencil holder for me, and I keep that for a while. Take a picture of it.
And so we did. We did some time trials with the tech deck.
But it actually turned out to be great. It was fun to just hang out with him, and he was sort of into the show. I'm not sure he understood what we were talking about half the time. But then he came on in the interview and was pretty inappropriate when I interviewed him.
Shocking stuff.
There was, I'm not going to lie, there was some revelations that he dished on. Probably not something that I'm proud about, but
who needs page six when you have Saul Cedar?
Yeah, this is
spilling the tea.
Not exactly a blind item either. Then we have this interview that I did with Saul Cedar. I don't think he was on camera, but we interviewed him, and there you go. That's a little birthday present to everybody. Not birthday, Christmas.
Christmas, yeah. Right.
Jesus' birthday.
Yes. Jesus' birthday.
Amen.
And also the new 2023's birthday coming up too. So enjoy those two things. We'll be back tomorrow with more. We've got some great best ofs this week. So check it out. Don't forget, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And also, Sunset Lake still has that Sebade, sunsetlakesebade.com. Head over there, and they're having a 2-for-1 on all of their smokables. So check that out. Of course, the Left is Best code still works over there. All right. See you. Well, you'll see you in a minute, but then we'll see you again tomorrow. Jordy. Okay. Want to welcome back to the program Lily Geismer. She is an associate professor of history at Claremont McKenna College, author of Left Behind, the Democrats' Failed Attempt to Solve Inequality. Lily Geismer, welcome back to the program. I think it's been a couple of years. We've had you on for your first book, Don't Blame Us, about suburban liberals dealing with the Massachusetts corridor around, I think it was 128. A couple of pieces that you wrote about that. And now you've written a book about really the ascendancy of the DLC. I just want to start, like, why was that the next obvious book for you to write?
Well, thank you so much for having me back on and for such a good memory of my my last appearances. The book Left Behind actually emerged in many ways from my my first book, which was looking at suburban liberals in Massachusetts. And the book ended with Mike Dukakis and his time as governor of Massachusetts, and then his run for presidency in 1988. And I was really interested in this as I was looking at Mike Dukakis, his embrace of tech as a solution to solving economic growth in Massachusetts, and how that then led to his being nominated for the presidency in 1988, and also his increasing use of the market and ideas of sort of using the market to do good. And I just wanted to think about how this was actually true of the Democratic Party more broadly. So how it became increasingly invested in using the private sector to do the work that was once largely it was advocated by Democrats that the government should do those kinds of programs, especially to help poor people and address problems of inequality.
I grew up in Massachusetts. I remember the Massachusetts miracle that was basically bringing a lot of those tech companies to that 128 corridor. And I remember when Bill Clinton was elected and looking around going like, I remember exactly where I was. And I remember, you know, everybody sort of like celebrating. And I thought like, oh, I can understand why there's a sigh of relief. But really, I was not that excited. And my understanding of the DLC and that whole turn that took place through that time was as a defensive measure. And I mix into this also Tony Coelho, who was a California Democrat who started raising a bunch of corporate money. And all these things sort of took place simultaneously. But you, your book sort of rejects that and makes the argument that this was actually sort of like a affirmative, like, ideological shift. Give us a sense, before we get to that part of it, how these people, and a lot of this came out of like the Southwest, how these Democrats perceive the Democratic Party, and then talk about where the shift came from.
Yeah, so that's absolutely right. So the thing that I tried to understand, I think the classic story of the DLC and the Democratic Party more broadly since the late 1960s is that everything that they did was in defensive reaction to the Republicans. And so the Republican Party is really the dominant story of kind of politics from the 70s onwards. And so when people like Bill Clinton and the cohort of New Democrats who are around the DLC were advocating for the market, it was all just kind of this, it's based on the idea of sort of how people think about it as triangulation, which was Dick Morris's famous strategy in the 1986 election. And so that it was just kind of stealing from the Republicans. And I wanted to look at how it wasn't just, I mean, there's a component of reacting to Republicans, but they actually really believed in the ideas of the market and to do good. And it is a bigger story than just Bill Clinton and goes back really to people like Tony Coelho and a broader group of Democrats who come into office in 1974 under the name at the time of the Watergate Babies. And Dukakis is one of them, as are people like Tim Worth and Gary Hart, who all have the idea that they're called the Watergate Babies because they came in 1974 after Watergate, but really who they were opposing was the traditional Democratic Party. And they believed that the Democratic Party had become too beholden, first to sort of ideas of bureaucracy and big government, and the party needed to be more efficient in its approaches to dealing with social problems. They were critical of the Great Society. But the other real problem they had is the Democrats had, there are two things. One is that they had become too beholden to what they called special interest groups, and especially the labor movement, and needed to kind of readdress its strategies in terms of kind of political strategy to really focus on more middle class, moderate suburbanites, who are many of their constituencies, and that's kind of the future. The other big thing was that the party's economic policies were too beholden to Keynesian economic theory and kind of too focused on, especially on, and with relation to labor, too focused on kind of manufacturing, and needed to focus on new, what becomes new economy sectors like tech, trade and finance. And so those things together would kind of be the future of the party. So that's really what they sort of begin to advocate in the 1970s. And it really comes to take hold by the 1980s and then the 1990s under Bill Clinton.
But the concept of efficiency, you mentioned that word, right? I mean, and as the party transitions to tech, finance, et cetera, that's a very financial or techie term as opposed to the Keynesian economics of the past. So, I mean, how did those interest groups and industries influence that kind of thinking within the party during that time?
It's interesting because I think there's this idea of like that they, you know, sort of being, having those kinds of relationships that where they're like, they're being sort of influenced in various different ways. And I think a lot of that comes later. There do become, and my book tracks actually like, especially the Democratic Party's relationship to Silicon Valley. But initially, the part of it has to do with there's a longstanding faith within liberalism and the Democratic Party in sort of technocratic approaches. And so this goes back to the New Deal, which was very technocratic in its nature. And there's a piece of the market itself that's quite kind of technocratic in its approach and is more efficient. And actually, there's a belief that it's more transparent, even though it's been, in many ways, those kind of relationships become not very non-transparent. But I think especially after the 1960s, where you have after Vietnam and then Watergate with this idea of government lying, there's a notion that sort of turning to the market will make it more both transparent, but also more efficient. And using bringing in the kind of ideas of the private sector will make government more effective. And that's really been this ethos that the Democratic Party has really promoted really since the 1970s, or a wing of the Democratic Party. And I think it's become kind of the mainstream idea that you need to make government more efficient. That's sort of how it operates. I mean, the DLC promoted the idea of like, we want to promote opportunity, not government, which is that kind of thinking.
I don't know, for some reason when you mentioned that, it also reminded me of McNamara too, right? I mean, who's brought in from Ford, I mean, to do this with the Vietnam War. Very efficient, or theoretically anyways. But I just want to go backwards just a little bit too, just to get a sense of like where this emanated from. Because I know, and then we can talk about also like, you know, what ultimately became their neoliberalism is slightly different from the neoliberalism that came out of like Mont Pelerin and Milton Friedman and that whole crew. But how much of this was also a reaction to the sort of emancipatory politics of the mid-60s? Because I know that, you know, the Democratic Party has a huge shift over the course of like those 20 years from the end of 1940s the end of the 1960s, where the Democratic Party had never won an election without a majority of white people. And then after late 1960s, never wins an election with a majority of white people. How much of that played into this? Like when we hear special interests, you know, and I think like in your first book, we see the beginning of the end of the relationship with the unions and the Democratic Party. But also we're talking about other special interests too, right? I mean, and when I hear that, I hear like black people, women. And how much of that was a pushback against that type of politics?
It's a combination. And so there's a language of, so a lot of the language that emerges. And so there's this iteration. So it's the Watergate babies who come into Congress, and they're often known actually as the first neoliberals or Atari Democrats. And they talk a lot about the ideas of shifting away from fairness to opportunity. And so fairness is a word that is deeply embedded in kind of ideas of social justice and the kind of social movements you're talking about, particularly the civil rights movement. And that it sounds like it's a minor move, but it's actually a major one, that if you can kind of promote ideas of opportunity, everyone has the chance to do that, which actually also is kind of market oriented in its thinking, because it's like the market can give everyone the chance to go ahead to be great. It's also meritocratic. And that goes back to some stuff I talked about in my first book as well. So that's the kind of language that they're using. And the belief is that the party had been too focused on kind of redistribution. And that was sort of the ways in which they were helping redistribution. And then also kind of these ideas of fairness, which is to give every group a say and to help groups in those ways. The Democrats of this kind of ilk are still in language focused on ideas of we want to help everyone, and we believe in equal rights for women, for people of color. But their strategies point in other ways, and I actually say that the ideology does just in many ways too. And that's kind of some of the ways that sort of giving the market is giving everyone an opportunity to do that, as opposed to actually taking steps to ensure that that's possible. And those do have their roots in the beginning in the 1970s, but really kind of come into being by the 1980s and 1990s.
And was there something about something that was going on, or in the nature of the Southwest, or the fact that there was like sort of, I don't know, more expansion going on in the Southwest at that time that led so many of these people who espoused, I guess, this ideology to come from the Southwest?
There's a couple of things that that lead to it, and I can get, if I don't want to be too overly weedsy, but I'll give the answer. So there are two different things that are going on. One is, it's interesting with the story. I can use the story of Bill Clinton in particular, who's more from the South, but in a state like Arkansas, was losing a huge amount of it lost a huge amount of its industry, that it was a very manufacturing sort of state based on the idea of smokestack chasing, where in the 50s they brought in all these companies who opened one company towns, but by the 70s those companies had left and moved production overseas. So they desperately were in need of industry, and people like Bill Clinton see what was going on in Route 128 and Silicon Valley as the solution to the problems of places like Arkansas. So there's this focus on that as the kind of going to save our states. That they also recognize the realignment that you described within the Democratic Party itself. And there's a whole wing of people who become part of the DLC who were Southern moderate Democratic governors like Chuck Robb of Virginia. And they recognize that how the Democrats are going to regain office is by focusing on white swing voters. So the people you described who are leaving the Republican Party, and that some of the ways by the time the DLC comes into by 1985, that was kind of what the language was perceived. So when the DLC starts, it's all white men, primarily from the South, and Southwest. That's part of what the idea of what they're trying to do, that they're worried the party is going to take a different direction. I think it's actually this really interesting moment, because there's like sort of this split as to where the Democratic Party could have gone in the 1980s. And this is the approach that they see as kind of critical to both ideologically what the party should do, but also in terms of its electoral strategy.
I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but the idea of wanting to replicate what happened at Route 128 in Massachusetts in Arkansas is a prime example of why almost the whole ideology doesn't work. There's just not enough to go around. It's not scalable. And that's ends up being a problem with a lot of these ideas.
Yeah, and that's a huge part of I look at this range of different market-based ideas that they promote, especially around things like banking and things like microfinance. And a lot of them are sort of small-scale solutions to much bigger problems. So there is the other issue. I mean, the major thing that's happening that is sort of underneath this, and I gestured to in a couple of places, is that the economy is going through a major recession in the 1970s. And there's this question of sort of, we need to come up with a solution to these problems. And so this is the future lit lies in tech and trade and finance, and we need to bring those across the country. And this becomes really part of the Democratic Party's what they're going to offer for the future. So that goes back to Mike Dukakis' example. It is really what Bill Clinton sells in the 1990s. And I think it's really fascinating because to your point of like saying this isn't going to work, like these ideas are still promoted. Like this is the whole, you know, turning coal miners into coders. Like there's this relentless idea in that faith and kind of that the tech industry can solve all of these problems when it's been proven time and time again, it just can't.
Well, I have a theory as to why it's so relentless is because those exact same people are still in power within the Democratic Party. And so they, you know, usually you come in with one idea and it's going to take you for the rest of your career from, you know, that's the way most people operate. But let me ask you this before, and I want to get into the details of like, of Shore Bank and of microfinance. It's just because you focus on those examples in particular. But why did they win? I mean, I think we're on the other side of that saga on some level. It's still hanging on white knuckled within the Democratic Party. But I think there's at least a lot of indications that philosophy has died. Or is, you know, in convalescence. But why did they win at that time?
So I think it's a couple of different things. I think that this that are happening, and that's a sort of critical question. So, and it, as I said, there was these moments of kind of, we look back to the 1980s for where the Democratic Party was, and this moment of kind of, that it's often for political historians, this moment of kind of failure, that there were two large losses at the presidential level. And so the party, you know, 1984 and 1988 are both really interesting because you had someone like Jesse Jackson in the primary, and that could have been a direction for the party at that point to go after the very special interest groups and to make that the kind of coalition of the party. The DLC promotes this other approach of kind of, we focus on moderate, we focus on the kind of moderate swing voters and largely white and not non-voters. That's what that sort of idea that you go after people who are not voting in elections would be the kind of Jesse Jackson approach to this kind of non-voter approach. That's part of what I think leads to sort of these narrow wins. And I think it's really important. Bill Clinton did not win by a huge landslide in 1992. It was a narrow victory.
He didn't even get 50%.
Yes. And so that's some of what happened. I mean, there was a third party candidate who skimmed off a fair amount of, it's a question of where that would have gone. I also think the issue is that one of the things is that Bill Clinton was a tremendously charismatic politician. So what I argue happens is that you have the DLC, and then they had this theory that to win for the Democrats to recapture power was to win the presidency, and you focus on the presidency to kind of gain dominance. And they needed a good candidate, and Bill Clinton was rising up through their ranks. They select him to be their chair, and so that becomes really effective. So you have this. I do think the ideology was really powerful, and Bill Clinton became a really, really powerful mouthpiece for it, and that leads to the winning in 1992. And then I think there's a number of things that happened in 1996, largely having to do with the economic growth of the 90s that leads Bill Clinton to the win again. But I think one of the biggest issues for the Democratic Party has been this effort to kind of recapture that moment for so long, and just understand, like, to kind of try to recreate those dynamics. And I think one of the things has been to focus on these candidates to try to get that way, which has created real problems in the kind of larger infrastructure of the party since. So that's goes to the kind of narrow win, but with really long-term consequences. Coupled with my argument would be in the book too, is that we often focus on elections, but actually it's like what happens in office when they enact policy that really matters. And so that there was all of these policies that are put into place that have really long-term and in many ways detrimental effects.
Right. I guess I was asking less about why he won the national election than as opposed to that sort of like interesting fight within the Democratic Party. And I mean, I'm trying to remember I feel like it was his charisma and he talked like a populist too. Like he and Obama had a similar sort of like ability to come off as a populist, even though they weren't
and turn it on during election years. I mean, without a doubt. 2012, Obama spoke very differently than how he governed.
Oh, yes. I mean, it was very much like an affect as much as it was, you know, Bill Clinton would go to McDonald's and they had to like tie him down so he wouldn't go to McDonald's was the like in the run up to. I mean, I remember that. That was the big story about Bill Clinton. He would, and the stories that they would always come out with, like he just spent his whole time talking to the guy at McDonald's. And that was like they had him jogging to work off his McDonald's. And that was all the in many respects, it was just sort of almost like a luck of a draw in terms of him winning that primary in 1992, I guess.
Well, the primary in 92 was a really complicated one with all these people, and he sort of did come out on top. I mean, he was a profoundly effective politician. And I think the other thing, and so with the DLC component, so they had this whole idea of we expand, you know, opportunity, not government, through free markets was really their mantra. And Bill Clinton was able to sort of, as you said, was able to promote that in a populist language that was really effective. And so this idea, and it was like the sort of we're coming in with kind of a new approach, we're new kinds of Democrats. And that notion after 12 years of the Democratic Party not holding power was, I think, was effective and pervasive in a number of different ways. I think the other thing, I mean, which I argue in the book, going back to like this being affirmative, is Bill Clinton really did believe, so like the DLC, and he really did help, as I show in the book, help to kind of solidify certain aspects of their policies as well. But he really believed in the idea of the market to do good for poor people. So this idea that you could kind of use the market to do what was traditionally the Democratic Party traditionally achieved through government, that you could sort of use the private sector to do those things. And that's something that he really had a belief in. So it wasn't just kind of pure political strategy.
I want to get into Shorebank, into the microfinance, but just tell us the concept of doing well by doing good. I mean, that's a nice sort of like, I don't know. A cake and eat it too type of thing, or I can't tell what that is. It's sort of a rationale, maybe.
Well, it's that, and so that my book looks a lot of that kind of language, and using that actually as a way to think about the dominant ethos of the DLC and Clinton, which is this idea that you can use the market to do what government could do, but also that that market can sort of grow at the same time. And so instead of like the traditional democratic approach or liberal approach would be to keep those separate. So you want to do well by doing economic growth and then having compensatory social welfare programs. You can fuse those together so that the private sector can do the work of government. And that's what I look at in the book, is this becomes kind of critical to the Democratic Party under Bill Clinton's governing strategy. Another language that's just caviar, cake and eat it too is a lot of language of win-wins. So this idea that like, and the idea of a win-win is that then it doesn't address the fact that like in a capitalist system or in when you're using the market, you have wins and losses. And so this idea that it's good for everybody. And that's really what becomes their the logic of the New Democrats DLC approach to governance.
That's also just Silicon Valley, is it not? Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like that phrase has been repeated in, you know, it's very much how, not to bring up Theranos, but they justify their kind of business practices and they attract a lot of neoliberal investors using that ideology, honestly.
Totally. And so that's, I think the thing about that I found, I mean, that's why you have this kind of coalescence of the Democrats with Silicon Valley, is that the ethos is actually quite similar. And so that they, and it's attractive. So it's not just about kind of the money, like let's pay, like, well, we're going to like give you lots of donations. It's actually that they believed in these ideas as well. And so in the book, I look extensively at their relationship with charter schools, which is a very much like doing well by doing good kind of idea too. And that's kind of, it becomes kind of critical to the language of how I think Silicon Valley and the Clinton version of the Democratic Party, the ideas that they promote.
That's certainly the quote that I'm going to use when I go work for Jeff Bezos in his new initiative that we haven't worked out yet, the details. But well, I talk about Shorebank and how that sort of plays into that whole thing.
Yeah, so one of the things the book tracks is this community development bank called Shore Bank, which is based in Chicago, or it was started in the 1970s, and it was the idea that you could use a commercial bank to do economic redevelopment in a low income community. And they were based in South Shore, which is the neighborhood in Chicago. It's actually where Michelle Obama grew up. And Bill Clinton becomes really taken with this idea that Shore Bank is successful in Chicago, and invites the founders to start a bank in the 1980s in Arkansas, based on this model. And Shore Bank at the time had also been working with Muhammad Yunus, who was the founder of Grameen Bank, which is kind of seen as the founders of microfinance and the ideas of microenterprise in Bangladesh, which is the idea of giving small loans to poor women to help them start their own businesses. And the people from Shore Bank tell the Clintons about Yunus. They become really, really taken with that idea. So they bring him to Arkansas as well to start a micro enterprise organization in the Arkansas Delta in the 1980s. And then when Bill Clinton's running for president in 1992,
does that have success? I mean, it almost sounds laughable. Like we're going to get each one of these poor women, they're going to start their own businesses. Like, who's going to buy this stuff? Like, everybody's got their own business and everybody's like, I don't know, selling like.
And the cream will rise to the top. The best of the best will come out of it. I mean, so it's just capitalism.
But that's not the theory, isn't that? Like, some's going to just like, we're going to get some people to explain. It's like, it's going to sustain everybody. I don't understand.
They don't care. I mean, they probably don't really think about sustaining everybody. They're fine with a certain level of, I mean, I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm talking over you, but.
No. I mean, it's an interesting idea because it's like, why this, and this was a really, I mean, microfinance, microenterprise by the early 2000s was this idea that sort of caught on like wildfire, and especially in internationally. And there's questions of if it actually works internationally as well. Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Prize, there's questions if it's working there. But I think the idea that this could work in the U.S. is one of the things that I look at. And what they want to do is actually to use it for two things. One is to do economic redevelopment, and these communities have lost all their businesses, but also to replace welfare. So it's the idea, like, you don't need wealth, like, you don't need to get welfare payments. You can turn your hobby into a business. So like, you love to sell coffee cake, like, you can do that and promote it. And then you can start, like, what the theory behind it is like, you can then, you'll be really good at selling your coffee cakes, and then you'll start your own coffee cake company, and then you'll employ other people in the town, and they can all work for you, and then you'll have this, that's the kind of self-sustaining growth. So that's like the idea behind it. And this was, I mean, the Clintons promoted this like crazy in the 90s. And then Hillary Clinton really made it part of her kind of mission as first lady, and then as senator, and then as first lady, actually, as a secretary of state later, internationally. And it's been proven widely not to work in the U.S., for many of the reasons that you can assume. I mean, and so I think it's this very idealistic idea. And so some of the idea of cream to rise with the crop, it's this idea that everyone at their core wants to be an entrepreneur. So I think that it's like this entrepreneurial based idea. What I argue in the book and other places is that this is one of the things it does. And this is actually also where it connects to Silicon Valley, because people like the founder of eBay love this. Like they are like really taken with this idea. But it actually sort of like obscures it by calling everyone an entrepreneur. It obscures fundamental class differences. So like Jeff Bezos and the woman selling coffee cake are not the same, but it's sort of putting them in the same category. So you don't address the fact that these people don't have stability. Like that's what you lose when you're an entrepreneur. And if you're taking away welfare at the same time, it has really, really negative impacts.
It seems insane to me on multiple levels, the idea that this is because I think you make the point in the book that like, there's nothing wrong with a microfinance, but to have it be the center point of a way of addressing these things is it that have it be the center. I mean, I think it would
and
be a great
the expense
add-on
of social programs.
But, well, yeah, that's right. The point. Yeah, is yeah. That like it, as an add-on after the fact, after you've it, but the idea that you're going to have enough micro financed businesses that grow to replace social services, and then the idea that like I'm a woman with one child who makes $18,000 a year. I don't have any intergenerational wealth. I don't have family or friends who are wealthy either. But I'm similarly situated as someone who does have all those things to make a chance to make. I'm making my big life's bet on this coffee cake. It's insane. It's insane to think that this is scalable. I can't wrap my head around how anybody thought that it was. I mean, on some level, I feel like, and this I think is too much of a psychological assessment, but both Barack Obama and Bill Clinton came from very messed up situations where their meteoric rise within the context of our country, I think, blinded them to the reality of, like, they just won the lottery. And essentially, they won life's lottery, and they just assume everybody else can, too.
Well, I think there's a lot. There's so much to that. I think that's, and also many other Democrats who believe in this idea are people who all had success in various different ways and sort of have a faith that that's the way you go forward. And I think absolutely. So the point I make in the book is, like, I don't think microfinance or microenterprise is a bad idea in and of itself. Like, if you have it on top of having a robust social welfare state, but the idea that this could replace it is faulty. And I think the problem is it then actually leads to, this is where we have increased inequality after the 1990s. So it actually sort of harms and leads to sort of further shrinking the social safety net to the point you have nothing. And for Bill Clinton in particular, like, he, and this is, it goes to also his larger promotion of welfare to work, is that he often would talk about this idea of kind of, it's not just the kind of that you'd have the money, but it's also the sort of psychological power of having a job. And so he really believed in this notion that, and that was good for your kids too, to see you have a job. And that goes to, like, this, his own sort of the psychoanalysis of his own childhood experience, that, like, for poor people, they need to have a particular kind of notion of a role model of success, and having mothers who work will do that.
Well, how much did the Moynihan Report play into their thinking?
I'm trying to think. I mean, there have particular ideas of sort of that, that women, you need to have sort of particular ideas of sort of strong families. I mean, I think the other thing that goes to the Moynihan Report, but more the story of sort of the welfare queens from it. And this is another thing I argue in the book, is that in some ways this is different than the welfare queen argument, because it's sort of saying, it's instead of saying, like, every poor person is, like, the potential entrepreneur, but it actually then blames people who don't do that. And so in the book, I use a lot of, I mean, this is, Clinton uses classic language of, like, play hard and work hard and follow the rules, but that inherently stigmatizes people who are not, like, who are purportedly not following the rules. And then those people get incredibly punitive punishment for it, be that losing welfare benefits, but then also this is coupled with all of the crime legislation of the 1990s. So those two things actually come to work hand in hand. So you have this idea of, like, it's like it's repositioning who is, like, a good poor person and a bad poor person. So, like, the successful microenterprise is, like, an entrepreneur is, like, a good poor person who's working hard, whereas, like, anyone else falls into this other category. Is deeply stigmatized and actually, like, often in prison for it.
And I feel
that,
like,
was a really, sorry, I feel like that really, really
no,
dark
no,
there.
No, but I feel like that narrative also works the other way in sort of, like, a Paul Ryan-esque type of thing, because if we set it up so that if you play by the rules, you get a fair shake, you know, the land of opportunity, it also then comes back around and says, like, and so if you're not doing well, that's because you're not playing by the rules. And you know, we start to get into sort of, like, Paul Ryan territory here, it feels like, in terms of that ideology. How is this neoliberalism, this notion of, you know, private-public partnerships and the idea of, like, we're just going to give, you know, we're going to help people in business and that's going to supplant the role of government, and then, you know, and I should say, we saw this all through the Obama administration in like Cass Sunstein and all sorts of other figures who had this similar ideology. How is that different from the neoliberalism of the Mont Pelerin strain that goes through Milton Friedman?
Yeah, and this is something I look at in my book too, which I was really interested in, is this idea. So oftentimes Clinton is lumped together with this kind of with these other forms of neoliberalism under Reagan and Friedman and the Mount Pelerin Society. And I see the difference as they still believe in a place for government. And so it's the idea of government as catalyst. So government is sort of what creates the spark between the public and private sectors in a way that there's still a place there that government has particular responsibilities to make those possible. The Mount Pelerin Society, Milton Friedman, this is a kind of grossly oversimplified version of it, but they really believe in sort of getting government out. So ideally someone like Paul Ryan or Jack Kemp, who is kind of his predecessor of sort of the compassionate conservative kind of ilk of Republican, their ultimate idea is that everything goes to the private sector. So like everything ultimately becomes privatized in a way that this version does not believe in. They still believe in this idea of government playing some particular role, but it's a more limited role than you would see in a under a more kind of socially democratic party. And I think what I argue in the book is that actually, like, I really believe that intent matters. So you could say that the outcome is exactly the same. You still have poor people in a position where the social safety net has been eviscerated. There's vast inequalities in all kinds of ways, but it's actually really important to understand what they were trying to do. And a lot of these programs, be it looking to the tech and promoting the tech industry or and various different forms of deregulation, the idea was this was actually going to help people.
Where are we? Is that epoch? Are we done with that era? I mean, are we too close to really be able to say it's definitively over? But is it? And I know this isn't, you know, as a historian, I'm asking you to project into the future. But in 15 years from now, are historians going to start to say, like, okay, it ended in, you know, I don't know, the second decade of the 20th century, this started to end.
I think of this, and I would be curious of both of your thoughts too on it. In my mind, it's culturally over to some degree. I mean, you don't have the Democratic Party did not in the 2020 election promote things like charter schools and all of the kind of market programs like micro enterprise that were so sort of quintessential. And I do think Obama did do a lot of that in the mid 2010 to 2012. And this kind of culturally tech doesn't hold the same place that it once did, but I still think it's affected policy in various different ways. And it's had long-term effects, on the ability to create certain kinds of policies. So while I see sort of someone like Biden is not using that kind of language, I still think the impact has still been there. And I do think there's the potential for those things to come back given sort of who holds power. And that's what's kind of dangerous. I think also the other place that's quite, if you think about it, just in terms of the Democratic Party, the other kind of component of this is that the Democrats have go time and time again back to this political strategy. So whereas the DLC is shut its doors and they don't, you know, Bill Clinton's not the marquee speaker anymore at conventions. There's still at every election, there's the idea that like, if we need to win, we should not be trying to kind of shore up marginalized people. But instead the solution to the Democrats winning office is to go after moderate suburbanites. And that's what happened in 2018. And I very much see that that's the way that the party seems to be turning right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole conversation about means testing the student loan debt. They are trying to appeal to that constituency that you talk about there, and this is Biden's political ideology. And I think, as you say, culturally we've moved on, and COVID, I think, was the death knell for it in terms of, you know, anybody a little bit younger and who's voting Democratic. But Biden is still very much committed to that, or he knows no other way, really.
Yeah, and I think there's some level of like we need to do more because I think there are two things going on. I think absolutely, like, one piece is that unlike the 90s, you do actually have a powerful left wing pushing back in a way that there was just that voice was somewhat was absent for a number of reasons in the 90s. But I think what's important is that Biden was a founding member of the DLC, and I think he's less ideological in many ways than Bill Clinton was. But a lot of the people who are his senior advisors are people like Bruce Reed, Gene Sperling, who were all heavily invested in this approach. And so there's a question of like that maintaining, that affecting policy in various different ways. And always, I think, taking those approaches of like, we need to both in terms of like, that's the right approach, but also this is the way to win and maintain power.
I just want to touch on that dichotomy you just talked about. You have an ideological element that, the Bruce Reeds, and then you have this sort of like political strategic one. What's the sequencing there? Obviously, like if I have this ideology, I'm going to seek out consultants who are going to say like, actually, strategically this meshes, right? Like, do we ever see a break? In other words, could we make an assessment right now that the White House is full of? Because I think, I think Joe Biden is, marginally relevant to relative to the people that he's surrounded himself with or who have, accrued. And so like Bruce Reed and one or two other advisors may be just as important, on some level, depending on who's countering them in the White House. I think there's an argument right now about student debt that probably plays this out. And you have both the policy people and the ideologues and the political people who are talking about how this is going to impact the politics. How much of that distinction is there through this story? And is there a sense that one of those cohorts can exist without the other? I mean, because I think we're sort of probably still have more of those people who believe this stuff politically and don't ideologically are not as married to it or may not be, but it's irrelevant because they're mercenaries on some level. And they've found a way that they make their money with this political advice, as opposed to these ideologues, which I think at this point has to be largely, just completely bankrupt. I mean, whether it's like the Gates Foundation, Rand Corporation saying like, your whole school choice, your whole school program was a disaster. You don't have the Arne Duncans anymore. You have them out. You don't have the Cass Sunsteins in this administration. It seems like the political people for the large part are still there, but not necessarily the ideologues.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so it's an interesting point because of that, with that, dimension. And I do think some people like Bruce Reed and Gene Sperling have shown some capacity for change, but they're not hardcore going after the kinds of programs that they did in the 1990s. And so a recognition that that's not sort of suited for the moment, but it is an issue of like, for genuinely trying to combat inequality, that canceling student debt would be a really critical way to get there. So if you actually believe in policies that want to achieve those results, that is how you go about it. And there's been we've seen real limitations of doing that. And so I do think that there is this place of particular kinds of political strategists making decisions. And I think I think the other thing that's different about the 90s, and I will go back to my point of like, as I said, I'm like, I started out saying like the Republicans don't matter, but like, I do think they do matter. I mean, I think that what's happened, the Republican Party has changed so dramatically in many ways since the 1990s, that is a force to contend with too. And I think they're very afraid of that and very afraid of kind of what the Republicans look like, even though in many ways that like you would think in some ways opening up the fact that there's no potential for bipartisan cooperation could actually lead to some programs. And something like student debt, they don't need to go through Congress for. So it's like, it is a thing of like, this is not appealing to our perceived white suburbanite who we need to win. Who we need to maintain Congress. And so therefore we're not going to do it.
Lily Geisberg, associate professor of history at Claremont McKenna College. The book is Left Behind: The Democrats' Failed Attempt to Solve Inequality. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, folks. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The majority report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
What is up, everyone? Nomi Keen.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? Check us out every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go throw up.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. 1/2. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$3 trillion sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. You call it satire, Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. We have a guest in studio today. For the fun half, this is a function of school ending just yesterday. Public school, I'd like to welcome to the program Saul Seder. Saul, is this your first time on the program?
I think I've been one time, but I didn't talk.
Okay, well, now you're here, you're talking. Tell us, school ended yesterday. Do you want to give us a sense of how school went this year?
Good.
Okay. And how did was it difficult with COVID, or was it a more or less a normal year?
It was kind of normal.
Kind of normal. Okay. Any specific things about third grade that you thought were unique or interesting or particularly good or particularly bad?
Not really.
Okay. Great. Good stuff. You want to talk more about politics?
No.
Well, you know, this is a politics show.
Yeah, I do, but I don't know anything about it, so.
You don't?
No, not
Are
really.
You sure?
Well, a tiny bit, but not really.
What do you think about Mitch McConnell?
I have no idea who that is.
What do you think about the Republicans in general?
Stuff.
Okay, great, great. Well, you're making me look like I really taught you well. It's good. Are you, anything, what are you reading these days?
Wings of Fire.
Wings of Fire?
Yeah.
What's that about?
Dragons.
Great. All right. Anything else you want to add? Is there anything that you wanted to touch on today?
No.
No? All right. Have you enjoyed being in studio?
Yes.
Yeah? What's your favorite part about the studio?
It has a bathroom.
Right. That's true. It is extremely convenient. It would have been a real drag if it didn't have a bathroom. Our last one didn't. I don't think you ever saw that one.
It didn't.
Oh, hey, will you talk about Disney for a little bit? What was your Disney experience like when we went to Disney World?
Really fun, actually.
It was? Every day?
Disneyland wasn't the fun.
Disneyland wasn't the funnest?
The Disney area.
Right.
Where we saw the castle thing. Probably Hollywood Studios was the funnest.
Oh, yeah? Okay. And how do you think I did as a father, just in terms of keeping my stuff together during that?
Not so good.
Not so good. Not so good.
Do you have any stories?
How many emotional breakdowns would you say I had during the trip?
let me count. I don't know, like 20?
20?
No, maybe a tiny bit less, like 15, but...
Okay, so that was about more or less two a day.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. How long did they last?
30 seconds each.
30 seconds each? Yeah, it's not too bad.
Yeah, you're not that good at stuff.
I'm not that good at stuff?
Yeah.
All right. I appreciate that. That's nice to say. Anything else about Disney you want to talk about?
Well, you did get me a 7-foot lightsaber.
That's true. Plastic.
Well, yeah. It was like,
too carried away.
Two lightsabers.
Yeah.
You put them together in like the Sith lightsaber, I think. No. Oh my god, I forgot the name of the guy who had it. And oh my god, but it was like two put together. But then you could take them apart and it would be two lightsabers. They're like 3.5 feet each.
Yep, they're pretty big, but they also collapse down, yes. So we were able to take them in the suitcase. That was the big thing. Anything you want to talk about movies? You want to talk about the last movie we watched together? Because it's pretty exciting for me.
God. I forgot what it was called, but it was a spaghetti western.
It was a spaghetti western, that's correct. It was the first of one. Which one was it?
I don't remember the first name, but it was...
Fistful?
Fistful of...
Dollars?
Yes.
Yes. And that was pretty good, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there's this... The ride, the Pirates of the Caribbean ride...
Yeah, you got to talk into the microphone.
The Pirates of the Caribbean ride was really fun.
Oh, that was fun. Yeah, we did have a good time with that. All right.
Can we get some baseball updates, Saul? How the baseball season went?
Oh, yeah, that was good.
Your baseball season, yeah.
Well, and Sam's as a coach as well.
I got two double plays in one game.
Yep,
that's
you
crazy.
Did.
What, yep. The reflexes.
One was completely self... self-assisted.
The unassisted.
Yeah, and that game I got 6 outs.
Yeah, yeah. And also, what'd you do with your hit? What are you hitting?
Oh, yeah, I got good hitting, I think.
Okay, good.
Saw the slugger.
Oh, yeah.
It was Darth Maul.
Oh, yes. I don't know if that's right, but...
Yeah, people are a little upset that you didn't know.
Yeah, I got coached by, we went to this base batting cages, and I got coached by the coach who coached Manny Ramirez in high school.
Yep. Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, a guy named Tito gave Saul some pointers and told us a couple of stories about Manny Ramirez. That was pretty good. All right, lastly, what is your favorite Jim Carrey movie? People want to know.
Probably The Mask.
Great the Mask?
Choice. Yes.
Do you want to do any Jim Carrey impressions?
No. Well, Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah. All righty then.
What did you think about what?
You need to do a better voice.
I know. Give me a few more times.
Do you want to say who you like better, Bradley or Matt?
I don't know.
Whoa! I folded that paper 7 times. So
that's true. He did. All right.
Well, Matt didn't try, so.
All right. Well, this has been great. Is there anything else you want to say before I kick you off the set?
Wait, what?
Well, I got to do the rest of the
show. Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I do have a riddle.
Okay.
What walks on 4 legs, 2 legs, and 3 legs in one lifetime?
4 legs, 2 legs, and 3 legs in one lifetime.
Yeah.
I would say a person. Start as a baby, then you walk, and then you need a cane.
Yes, correct. It's not really legs, but yeah.
Oh, all right. I got it. I can't believe that. All right. Well, there you go.
Okay. I'm just going to leave these headphones, like, right here.
Yep.
Like, oh.
All right. Well, thank you, Saul, for joining us. That was a real treat for, I think, for, you know, a couple of people.
Dad?
Yeah?
Could I sit here the whole time?
Yeah, you can.
Yes.
But you got to go get your book. I mean, you can listen to the show. You can do whichever one you want.
Yeah, I'll grab my book.
Okay. All right, folks, you're welcome for that part of the program. It was a little treat. We will, maybe we'll do that again someday. Yep, maybe. I thought you were pretty good. You did a pretty good job. You'll be taking this show over. You're taking over the old man's business.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive, between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. While I shifted in and out of gear, waiting for my moment to happen. I don't know how much longer I can stay in, or how much more I've got to fade to play in. I know somehow